7 in 10 full-time workers would consider switching jobs for better benefits. Benefit strategies are crucial to building a competitive advantage. But how can employers meet diverse priorities across industries and demographics? Benefits 2.0 from Economist Impact, supported by Nuveen, a TIAA company, explores how benefits empower individuals, elevate companies, and drive the U.S. economy. Search Economist Impact Benefits 2.0 to learn more. Sponsored by Nuveen, a TIAA company.
The Economist. Hello and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm your host, Jason Palmer. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world. Stock markets around the world are on fire. Japan's Nikkei index is as high as it's ever been. So if you've got money to invest, it might be tempting to put it all into stocks. Calm down, let's look at the historical record first. And you may have heard the statistic that San Francisco has more dogs than children. My dog-loving colleague wasn't convinced, so she had to dig through the data to find out which American cities, in fact, have the most puppy love. But first, in Gaza this weekend, destruction from above as Israeli airstrikes continued relentlessly. But even as Gazans dug through the rubble, more came from the sky. Aid drops by Americans and Jordanians arrived beneath small parachutes, sending people on the verge of famine scrambling to intercept them. This just days after more than 100 Palestinians were killed around a Gaza City aid convoy in disputed circumstances. In Cairo over the weekend, some ground was laid for negotiations. A six-week ceasefire is reportedly on the table, and Hamas representatives are there. But before joining, Israeli representatives want more information on the hostages still held by Hamas.
The talks are still continuing in Cairo, not directly between Israel and Hamas because they don't speak directly to each other, but through Egyptian and Qatari brokers. There are some obstacles still in the talks, but there's also some optimism that an agreement for a temporary ceasefire and the release of Israeli hostages can be reached by the unofficial deadline of the eve of Ramadan, which is next Sunday.
Anshul Pfeffer writes about the Middle East for The Economist.
The American administration is heavily invested in the talks, and we're seeing various statements putting pressure on both sides. A couple of days ago, a named White House source said Israel has, in principle, accepted the framework of the agreement while Hamas is still playing tough. Yesterday, Vice President Kamala Harris made a statement which was probably the toughest statement towards the Israeli side, talking about the urgent need for a ceasefire.
The conditions are inhumane. And our common humanity compels us to act. The immense scale of suffering in Gaza, there must be an immediate ceasefire. For at least the next 6 weeks, which is what is currently on the table.
Pressure for a ceasefire from the Americans has been increasing since the carnage on Thursday morning in Gaza City around the aid convoy.
And what happened there? Why is that such a big issue at this point?
Well, for a start, over 100 people were killed. The actual details are contested. The Palestinians claimed that Israeli forces were shooting into the crowd around the aid convoy, around the trucks. Israel says that the stampede around the truck had nothing to do with Israeli forces who were several hundred meters away when it happened. And they had only opened fire in a separate incident when a crowd started moving towards the Israeli checkpoint. But the Israeli claim is that most of the casualties were caused in the stampede in which Israel was not involved. Regardless of the actual details of what caused the stampede, the fact that there is so much chaos around any delivery of food and supplies to Gaza City and other parts of Gaza just shows us how there is desperation due to hunger and how there really isn't anybody dealing with it.
And that, I suppose, is what's prompted America to airdrop some aid in.
The American airdrop is really just a drop in a bucket. It's 30-odd thousand ready meals from some kind of American military stores. It's not a restoration of food supplies. It's really almost like sort of a gesture in which the Americans are both trying to show that they're doing something. And also, I think in a way, shame the Israelis for not having put in more organized distribution routes.
A drop in the bucket, it may be, but is it significant to you that the Americans are stepping in here with aid in a way that clearly Benjamin Netanyahu does not want to do?
Well, Netanyahu and his government haven't really had a clear policy on aid to civilians in Gaza, really from the beginning of the war. In the immediate aftermath of October 7, Israeli ministers were saying no way that Israel will supply Gaza after the attack on Israel. And then the policy changed to any supplies that come through Egypt. Then Israel changed the policy saying, well, yes, aid can come through an Israeli crossing as well, but Israel won't be actually involved in distributing the food and other essential supplies in Gaza. And that has changed again in recent days, where we've seen Israeli troops within Gaza starting to facilitate the supplies. And this is also where all the casualties on Thursday morning happened, at a convoy which was facilitated by Israel, but it wasn't secured by Israeli soldiers beyond the checkpoint. There wasn't really anybody there to make sure that thousands of people wouldn't jump on the supply trucks. So what we've seen from Israel is a really inconsistent policy on supplies to Gaza. And I've spoken to a number of Israeli officers at different levels who have said, we totally understand that there's the army currently occupying Gaza. We're also responsible for Gaza's humanitarian needs. We had the plans to make it happen. What we're waiting for is a clear idea from the government what the policy is.
And what in turn does that tell you about how Gaza can be governed after this conflict finally ends?
That's a great question that nobody has a very good answer for. What is happening in Gaza now is that for the last 16, 17 years, Hamas was in charge after it carried out its coup against the Palestinian Authority. Hamas will no longer be in charge in Gaza. At least that's Israel's intention. That's what Israel has been doing for the last 4.5 months to try and ensure that doesn't happen. But the Palestinian Authority doesn't have the capacities to return to Gaza yet. And Israel talks about there being local elements within Gaza which can take care of the civilian affairs. But from what we're seeing now, if those local elements exist, then they're crime gangs and warlords and nothing really well organized that can take care of civilian needs. Netanyahu, in a document that he presented to the Israeli cabinet 10 days ago, wrote that the civil affairs will be carried out by a local group who haven't supported terror. That is a very, very broad definition that is basically there to rule out whoever Israel doesn't want.
So coming back to the notion of ending this conflict, there are Hamas representatives in Cairo, America clearly increasing its pressure on Israel to do something, saying that a ceasefire is on the table. What are the sticking points here? What's to look out for?
Well, first of all, we have to make it clear that we're still talking about a temporary ceasefire. None of the negotiations are right now about a ceasefire which will last more than the month of Ramadan, perhaps 6 weeks. That's what's on the table now. And I think the Americans are pushing for that because they understand that the idea of a permanent ceasefire right now is something which will be too difficult to sell to the sides. That's why they're first of all trying to get a temporary ceasefire that will work for a month or so. The sticking points in the negotiations right now are mainly about what the partial ceasefire will look like. Will it just mean no firing, no fighting in that sense? Or will Israel also withdraw its troops, which are still in Gaza, from the area? Hamas want full freedom of movement in the entire Gaza Strip. Israel's prepared to allow only limited movements from the north to south, with perhaps women and children and elderly people allowed to move back into Gaza City, but not men of military age. And another sticking point is that Israel demands to be informed by Hamas who are the hostages that it holds are still alive.
We've spoken to you a lot since the October 7th attacks, and a lot of what you're saying sounds like what you would have said you did say in the days immediately after the attacks. What's your view on how close we are in the interim and all this time towards a lasting peace, towards a solution that saves lives?
Well, that really depends on who is deciding Israel's war aim. Now, Netanyahu is talking about a total victory, but he's not really explaining what a total victory is. If you talk to the more pragmatic members in the war cabinet and to generals in the Israeli army, they talk of the need to have one last big push towards Rafah. They're not in a rush to do that. They also don't want to do that over the month of Ramadan because they're aware that there could be flare-ups of violence in other places. So currently there is no move towards that. And the talk in the Israeli military is actually a pause in the fighting would work for them well now. And then they could decide or work out how to go about attacking Hamas's last stronghold in Rafah. But from Netanyahu, you don't hear any of that talk of pause. As far as he's concerned, Israel's going ahead right now to a total victory, which is a meaningless term. So it really depends who you listen to on the Israeli side. A deal for a temporary ceasefire will not only give the people in Gaza respite for the month of Ramadan and for Israel, dozens of hostages coming home after being in captivity for 5 months. It'll also finally allow aid organizations, whether international or locally based, to establish some kind of distribution system in Gaza, because what we're seeing right now is chaos, and that chaos is what caused all the casualties on Thursday morning.
Anshul, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for having me, Jason.
Seven in 10 full-time workers would consider switching jobs for better benefits. Benefit strategies are crucial to building a competitive advantage. But how can employers meet diverse priorities across industries and demographics? Benefits 2.0 from Economist Impact, supported by Nuveen, a TIAA company, explores how benefits empower individuals, elevate companies, and drive the U.S. economy. Search Economist Impact Benefits 2.0 to learn more. Sponsored by Nuveen, a TIAA company.
For watchers of and investors in the world's stock markets, 2024 is proving to be a white-knuckle ride.
We got it. 5K on the S&P and a new record closing high, although just shy of closing at
the S&P 500 index of big American companies recently passed 5,000 for the first time. And this morning, Japan's Nikkei index hit its own record high. So lots of money to be made in stocks then, which revives an old question. Should investors leave bonds behind and go all in on equities?
When stock markets are roaring, as they have been recently, there is a pretty strong incentive to invest more in stocks.
Mike Bird is The Economist's Asia business and finance correspondent and a host of our sister podcast, Money Talks.
And there is an argument that 100% allocation to stocks is likely to beat the more diversified approach to investing. So say three academics, that's Aizan Anarkalova, Scott Cederberg, and Michael O'Doherty. It's based on research going back as far as 1890. Some academics go even further. There is an argument that young people should be borrowing money to buy stocks, deleveraging later and diversifying their exposure. That's because basically compound interest is a very powerful thing. The more returns you make at a very young age, the better. Understandably, when the market is roaring, this sounds to some people like a pretty compelling argument.
You say to some people, but not to all people, I guess.
No, not to everyone. There are some people who think this is being looked at all wrong. Basically, there's not a lot of argument that stocks have a higher expected return than other assets. That's not the bit here that's in doubt. What's important is what return you're getting for the amount of risk you're taking. So the prominent advocate of that argument is a guy called Cliff Asness. He's the founder of AQR Capital Management. He says that the best portfolio is the one that gives you the best risk-adjusted return, which you should then leverage up if you feel like it. That's the best way to approach it. Now, you've got to remember that Cliff Asness and other people who make these arguments, they're pros, they're professional investors, comfortable with leverage. But still, the argument holds that the portfolio with the highest expected return isn't necessarily the best one if you end up taking a lot more risk than you're comfortable with. If you're not comfortable with that sort of volatility, you might want something different.
But for someone who is not a pro, how to find the right risk to reward balance here if these sort of argument and counter-argument are out there?
Well, it's a good question. And if it was easy, then I suppose everyone would already know. But basically, you have to think about an extremely long time horizon. If you're, say, just coming out of university, it might be 50 years before you're going to retire. Even if you're in your 40s, you've probably got a few decades ahead of you. You need to know what those decades might look like. And the best way of thinking about that is, what's the historical record here? In a normal 20-year period, looking back through the history of financial markets, what should I be looking at? What's my upside? What's my downside? The problem is that the history of financial markets really just isn't very long. And the paper we were talking about earlier goes back to the late 19th century. But if you're thinking about 50-year periods to invest over, there's really only two of those in that period. It really doesn't give you a huge amount of information as to the risks, and especially the sort of very unlikely risks that you wouldn't want to stumble across. A much longer term view is found by Edward Macquarie. He's a professor. He's found that between 1792 and 1941, stocks didn't consistently outperform bonds in the way that we expect them to. Some decades, bonds outperformed stocks. They basically tracked each other for a very long time. So these sort of big components of what we understand to be solid financial advice don't always hold perfectly.
Well, but also, whatever the long-term trend is, data from the 1700s doesn't have a whole lot to say about today, right?
Absolutely. Finance changed hugely since 1941, never mind 1792, as fun as it is for historians to look at. But I think it leads to the point that whatever is happening in 2074 will look very different to what's happening now. When we talk about stocks going up in the long run, most people are really referring to a few decades of the latter half of the 20th century. Investors have to be concerned not just with the measurable risks that they've seen, but the unknowable uncertainties of what might happen. So diversification might feel quite difficult when stock markets are booming. You see other people making more money than you. It feels very painful. But for investors who are standing firm, the history does suggest that stocks don't always outperform. People tend to appeal to the long-run performance of the stock market when they're arguing for these slightly more risky portfolios. The truth is, the long run simply isn't long enough to make that argument.
Mike, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
One caricature of millennials, alongside eating too much avocado toast, is that we treat our pets like children. And I can say this because I am myself a millennial.
Aaron Braun is The Economist's West Coast correspondent.
We carry them around in strollers. Spot is not just a dog. He is a fur baby. Except he's probably not named Spot because human names for dogs are now all the rage in America.
Yeah, no, as an aside, it is all the rage seemingly in Britain, but go on.
Jason, do you have a pet with a human name?
I do. I have a cat named Jerry.
That's fitting.
He came with that name, actually, to be fair.
Well, over here, on this side of the pond, there's now some overlap between the top 10 names for dogs and the top 10 names for babies. So Luna and Theodore are on both lists, though for dogs, as you can imagine, it's the cuddlier Teddy that's in vogue. And actually, Jason, have you heard that in recent years, people have been talking about how there are more dogs than kids in San Francisco?
Yeah, and I'm inclined to believe it, but I wonder if it's true.
When I first heard that, I thought, oh, of course, this is an idiosyncrasy that makes sense in a city with tiny apartments, lots of dog parks, lots of wealthy millennials. But I kept reading, and then I read the same thing about Denver. So I wanted to find out if this was just a weird San Francisco or Western United States thing, or if it's more common than we think for cities to have more dogs than babies. So I looked into the data.
Where I guess the first question is it actually true anywhere? But okay, tell me about your research methods then. How do you get to the bottom of this potential legend or weird fact?
So very quickly, I found out that it would be basically impossible to compare the raw number of dogs to the raw number of children in these cities. Not every city has an estimate for the number of dogs that exists there. And even if it does, you can't be sure that New York is counting canines in the same way that Chicago or Los Angeles does. But in 2021, the United States Census asked Americans about what kind of pet that they had. So we used census data to compare the proportion of households with children under 18 to the share of households with dogs in the 15 biggest metropolitan areas in America.
Okay, go on.
The results are not what you might expect. Riverside, which some people may not have heard of, but which is kind of the suburbs and exurbs east of Los Angeles, takes the biscuit. It has more dogs than any other metropolitan area. Nearly half of homes there have a tail-wagging tenant. Phoenix and Dallas rounded out the top three for dog ownership. And if any of you are as obsessed with dogs as I am, you can see a chart showing this in the United States section of economist.com. Six of the 15 cities I looked at, actually, as well as America as a whole, have more homes with dogs than kids. But interestingly, San Francisco is not one of them.
It was a legend after all.
A myth.
But coming to the places where it actually is true that there are more dogs than kids, why? What is it that makes a city pup-cessed?
Ouch. I'll let that slide because I actually wrote that in my story, but otherwise it hurts. There is no clear geographic trend. The cities with the biggest gaps between the number of homes with dogs and those with kids were all in the Sun Belt. It was Phoenix, followed by Riverside and Dallas. But right behind was Detroit, Seattle, and Philadelphia. So that's kind of a weird geographic mix of cities. There is a correlation, however, between household space and dog ownership. So dogs were more prevalent in cities where single-family homes are common. And that makes sense, right? I live in Los Angeles, and if I had a huge house and a big backyard, I would probably have like 5 Bernese Mountain Dogs. But I live in a tiny apartment, so I have 0. And the best example of this correlation is that just 22% of homes in New York City have a dog. And so, you know, pity the pup that's cooped up in a tiny apartment in Tribeca or the West Village. They don't know what they're missing.
So you just created an entire generation of dogs that are just thinking, oh, I wish I lived in California.
Like the rest of us, I guess.
Aaron, still our correspondent with the happiest assignment in the company. Thanks very much for your time, as ever.
Thank you, Jason.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. It's a mere 13 days until... You know what important day is on March 17th, don't you? No, not St. Patrick's Day. It's the end of our half-price promotion on Economist Podcasts Plus. Get in there soon to get access to a pile of seriously insightful stuff. In an episode that dropped just yesterday, my colleagues on Next Year in Moscow, our acclaimed series from last year, returned to take stock of Russia's war as seen from inside Russia. Economist Podcasts Plus is a non-stop flood of our quality journalism that costs less per month than a half a pint of Guinness. Do it, and see you back here tomorrow.
World peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream, but what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world. And in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.